for calling Westchester Pediatrics.
Planning to get a flu shot today? Well, it's a very simple process.
If you have a question about the flu vaccine, please dial 6. Flu vaccine this year will be 2 separate vaccinations.
Bring your kids into the doctor, no complications.
One for regular seasonal flu, recommended for all children ages 6 months to 18 years.
Just one problem, though, a minor thing.
The vaccine for H1N1 flu, also known as swine flu, is not yet available.
Maybe all we need is a shot in the arm and a little Tamiflu in our veins. But you won't find it here on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, October 6th. I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry.
You know, I think we should hand out vaccinations here on the show, actually. I think
really?
That would be a good thing. Yeah, it would be a great sort of a pledge builder.
I think that would get people calling, huh?
Good morning, everyone. This hour we'll go to Afghanistan for a conversation with an officer on the front lines and the unappetizing demise of the legendary food magazine Gourmet. It's getting downright Condé Nasty in the magazine business, plus backstabbing in office politics, thriving in the tough economy. Did you have any doubts?
First, let's bring in Dr. Sandra Arnold. She's an associate professor of pediatrics in the Division of Infectious Diseases at the University of Tennessee, Memphis, and she works at Le Bonheur Children's Hospital. So give me the down low here, Dr. Arnold. Is the vaccination for H1N1 safe? Some people say it's been rushed to the market. So is it experimental or is it safe?
No, it's certainly not experimental. It's quite safe. It's been manufactured in the same way that seasonal influenza vaccines have been manufactured, and so there's no reason to think that its safety profile should be any different than the vaccines that we receive every year.
More on that with Dr. Arnold in just a moment. First, everything else you need to know this morning.
In the headlines, the situation in Afghanistan and Pakistan tops President Obama's agenda today. He's meeting with a bipartisan group of lawmakers. Top Regional Commander General David Petraeus has undergone treatment for prostate cancer. He was diagnosed early. Treatment was apparently successful.
The Wall Street Journal reports this morning that the Pentagon will create 2 new units focused on the Afghan war. Their mission includes helping U.S. troops understand how Afghanistan's political and tribal systems function. The Senate Finance Committee is putting off a vote on its health care plan until tomorrow at the earliest. They're waiting on final cost analysis from the Congressional Budget Office.
It's going to be cheaper to heat your home this winter. Today's government forecast on natural gas and propane costs is expected to show double-digit drops.
And North Korea says it may be willing to return to international nuclear talks. State media reports Kim Jong-il made that announcement to China's premier. So Wall Street gained about 1% yesterday. The Dow opens up at 9,600. The S&P starts trading at 1040. And the NASDAQ will begin at 2068. America's fight in Afghanistan as of tomorrow will have lasted for 8 years. That's been a long road for many people, especially those who have served or have loved ones serving overseas. All this week, we're going to bring you different takes on the war in Afghanistan and the progress there. But mostly, we want to know how it's affected you. What is your story and what has your family been going through? And how do you think we should progress with the war in Afghanistan, if we should progress? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Coming up, everything you need to know about the swine flu.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. Doses of the H1N1 vaccine are now available, but they're available for a very small number of people. Some of them were given out at the Le Bonheur Children's Medical Center in Memphis, Tennessee. John?
I've got a list of questions for these guests. I hope you don't mind. I mean, I got pregnant wife, 4 kids at home. I got a million questions.
I got other stuff to get
to. I know. I just want to know, you know, I'm going to be chiming in here.
Okay, but, you know, you have to keep it.
I know. I just got a million questions on this flu.
You just can't flood them with questions.
But that's what's happening all over America.
That's what we're told. We are joined by 3 doctors this morning to tell us about what's up with the vaccine and who's going to get it first. Dr. Matthew Davis is a pediatrician and internist at the University of Michigan. He's a health policy researcher, and he directs the National Poll on Children's Health there. Good morning, Dr. Davis.
Good morning.
So what have you been hearing from parents? Are your phone lines jammed with people calling in with questions?
Well, we have a lot of parents eager to hear when the H1N1 vaccine is going to be available. And what we've been letting them know is that we expect the vaccine to be available for patients later on this month or the first part of next month. Our priority is to get healthcare workers vaccinated first.
So we also have Dr. Anthony Fauci. He's director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. So, Dr. Fauci, we were talking about the vaccine being rolled out in small doses right now. Where is it going first and why?
Well, it's just going to go to relatively few places. The first installment was about 600,000 doses. By the end of the week, there'll be about another 6 to 7 million doses. And then after that, there will be coming in about 40 million by mid-October, and then about 10 million a week after that. So it started really very slow, only because the first shipment was just available from the flu mist, which is the spray in the nose. But the injectable is going to become available literally within a week or so.
I've got a question. I have to ask this.
Okay.
Dr. Fauci, John Hockenberry here. Why can't pregnant women use the nasal
mist?
Why?
Strictly speaking, they probably could, but out of an abundance of caution, since this is a live attenuated vaccine, we just want to make sure it has not really been tested that much in women on a seasonal basis who are pregnant. It's a theoretical risk that is very, very small, but just out of an abundance of caution, we want women to take the injectable
because
it is a live virus, so very attenuated.
Thank you. That's the first time I've had an explanation on that. Go ahead.
So actually, John, you might want to hear from Dr. Sandra Arnold, because not only did she get the vaccination herself, she got the mist in her nose, but she has daughters, and they both had H1N1, right, Dr. Arnold?
Well, I'm pretty sure they did. They had influenza-like illness that I was pretty certain that they had it, although they were not tested.
Now, you're still going to get them vaccinated?
I absolutely am. I'm not certain that they had it, and I want to protect them. I want to protect the people around them. You know, children are the ones that spread the virus to everybody else. So I want to make sure that everybody's protected.
All right. So, Dr. Arnold, let me just give you a sense of my house. We got four kids, two sets of twins, two 11-year-olds, two 8-year-olds, all right, and a pregnant woman in the third trimester. Absolutely everybody gets vaccinated, including daddy. That's what you say?
Absolutely.
Why not Tamiflu? Absolutely. A lot of people are saying that you should have used Tamiflu instead.
You're still going to get sick if you take Tamiflu. This way, this is the only way that you can keep yourself from actually getting influenza. If you take Tamiflu, generally you wait till you get sick. If you take it as a prevention when you've been exposed, you may have to take it over and over again.
All right, I got a question for Dr. Matthew Davis. Excuse me, Celeste. This is, again, one from my wife. She's in the third trimester. If she gets a vaccine, Dr. Davis, does she pass the immunity to the baby that's going to be born in December and is still going to be facing a flu threat through the spring?
That's a great question, John. We do think there is some benefit for the mom essentially sharing her antibodies with the child who's about to be born, but the main benefit probably comes after the child's birth, within the first 6 months, when children are not yet eligible to be vaccinated against either H1N1 flu, what used to be called swine flu, or seasonal flu. That brings up another issue, which is that individuals taking care of very young children are recommended to get the H1N1 flu vaccine, even if they don't otherwise fall into a high-risk category themselves.
And that was my question, Dr. Fauci. Why is that? With the very young children are not in the high-risk category, and yet we're going to vaccinate caretakers for those very young kids. Why is that?
Well, very young children, less than 6 months, are in a high-risk category, but you don't vaccinate them because their immune response is immature, and they do not make a good immune response against a vaccine. So as you've just heard, the real strategy is to form almost a cocoon effect around them by vaccinating the people who are caretakers of children less than 6 months old. If their immune system were mature enough to be able to make immune response against the vaccine, we would vaccinate them. But that doesn't mean that they're not at risk. You still need to protect them by not allowing anyone who's infected to be near them, and that's why you vaccinate the caretakers.
But is it the case that if you're vaccinated, you can't be a carrier of the virus?
If you're vaccinated and the vaccination really works, you will not be infected. So you will not be, as it were, subclinically shedding the virus. The virus would have to be replicating in you enough for you to shed it. And if it is, that means that the vaccine didn't work. So if the vaccine works, not only will you be protected, but you would not be passing it on to anyone else.
I am working through this list here.
So, Dr. Davis, you just led a national poll about parents and their attitudes about the H1N1 vaccine. And I'm wondering what you found out. Are parents nervous about vaccinating their kids?
Well, Celeste, what we did find is that parents seem a bit more reluctant to go with the H1N1 vaccine than they are with something they know a little bit better, which is the seasonal flu vaccine. So about 40% of parents nationwide plan to get their children between the ages of 6 months and 18 years vaccinated against H1N1. In comparison, about 55% of those same parents plan to get their kids vaccinated against seasonal flu. What I've been emphasizing in my practice is that the vaccines are essentially the same vaccine, just with a small change to make the H1N1 vaccine directed against the actual H1N1 virus. But we're expecting the rate of side effects, such as soreness or redness of the arm, or perhaps a very low risk of fever or muscle aches, to be about the same as we've seen with the seasonal flu vaccine for children. And that's actually been a very, very helpful and quite safe vaccine for kids over the past half decade or so.
Okay, that's Dr. Matthew Davis. He's a pediatrician and an internist at the University of Michigan. We're also joined with Dr. Anthony Fauci. He's the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases from Washington. And also from Memphis, Tennessee, Dr. Sandra Arnold. She's associate professor of pediatrics in the Division of Infectious Diseases at the University of Tennessee. I kind of think, John, that maybe you assembled this panel of doctors just to get through...
Call on me. Yeah. So, Dr. Arnold, I have one last question. Maybe it's a little bit ghoulish. The Centers for Disease Control suggested over the last few days that 28 women or more had died of the flu itself, and that that was
pregnant women, right?
28 pregnant women. That was a disturbing figure, but they also said that they don't typically track pregnant women during the seasonal flu, so they kind of don't know whether this is a high number or not. First of all, are you disturbed by that number? And second of all, what are these pregnant women dying of? How does that work?
Well, I am disturbed by that number. Of course, we're always upset when anybody passes away from something that is potentially preventable, like influenza. What I would say, since I'm not caring for these women, I can't actually say what's going on. I think usually what we see when people die of influenza is a combination of people having a severe immune reaction and pneumonia secondary to the influenza virus itself. As well, we might see people getting pneumonia due to bacteria that have an opportunity to get into the lungs when there's a respiratory virus like influenza present.
So, Dr. Fauci, you know, there are always a lot of deaths from seasonal flu, even. It's one of the top 10 leading causes of death in the U.S. But they're also calling that this a pandemic, and I know that we've lost millions of people when we've had pandemics in earlier decades. Are we prepared? Are we maybe predicting that we're going to have we're prepared for this pandemic and we're going to see fewer deaths from it this time?
Well, the way this pandemic is acting is that the pandemic definition is because it spreads very, very rapidly. This has really been extraordinary how rapidly this has spread from the first cases that we saw in April in California and in Mexico, now throughout the world. So in that respect, it's a classic pandemic. As a broad big picture, it is not an overwhelmingly severe pandemic in the sense that it is a relatively mild to moderate disease. One of the disturbing aspects is that seasonal flu, which, as you just mentioned correctly, kills about 36,000 people a year in the United States. The overwhelming majority, 92%, are elderly individuals older than 65, and the majority of them older than 80. This particular pandemic that we're in now is a little bit different.
And it gets
Although
young
the
people.
Deaths are relatively few, they tend to be dominant among very young people, sometimes very healthy people.
Okay, great. That's Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. From Ann Arbor, we had Dr. Matthew Davis from the University of Michigan and Dr. Sandra Arnold, who deals with pediatrics and infectious diseases at the University of Tennessee in Memphis.
Hey, you want that to go?
Now, some quick takeouts on stories we're following all this week. We're going to go first to Louise Story, finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Louise, very sad news in the magazine industry. What happened at Condé Nast?
Good morning, Celeste. this is a real moment in journalism. You know, Condé Nast is one of those places you walk in and you feel like you're in a fashion show. I don't know if either of you have been in there.
Yes. I always feel poorly dressed when I'm in the Condé Nast building.
I mean, the rest of us journalists often walk around with ink on our hands, but the people at Condé Nast are so glamorous and they're kind of considered, you know, the most exciting, you know, place to work. And so this is a moment. It's one we've seen coming. It was reported over the summer that they'd hired McKinsey to come in and look at cost cutting. There were a lot of different posts on blogs about how the Orangina was taken out of the closets there, which was a real shocker to some people.
And they closed Modern Bride. They closed several of their magazines in order to cut corners. It wasn't enough.
Well, so the big one they're closing is Gourmet,
you
know, which has been around for decades. It's really legendary in the cook world as well as just the, you know, people who love food. So between that and three others, they're going to let 180 people go. But keep in mind, in the last few years, they've shut at least seven magazines. You know, they shut Domino, they shut House and Garden. So they've really cut a lot of the fat. And it's kind of interesting if you look at the list of what's left. You have to say, what else could you shut? I mean, would you shut The New Yorker? Would you shut Vanity Fair, Vogue, Wired, Architectural Digest, Self? I mean, these are iconic titles that are left there now.
So is this the beginning of the end?
Well, I mean, I certainly hope not. And, you know, you think that magazines with their glossy pictures will survive this change to the internet that, you know, people will want to flip through them, but it's not certain how long that will last as more and more people are reading things on Kindle and on the internet.
Okay, Louise Story, finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Thanks.
Our next takeout comes from Ibrahim Abdelmateen, Takeaway Sports contributor, and he called it. The Vikings and the Packers went head-to-head last night. They met. It was a test of Brett Favre and also just an extraordinary rivalry between the Packers, who used to have Favre, and the Vikings, who now have the 40-year-old Favre. How did it go?
Well, the Minnesota won 30-23. Green Bay had 23 points. I think the game came down to in the third quarter when on fourth and one front in the goal line, Aaron Rodgers of the Green Bay Packers stepped back to throw a pass, and a guy named Donald Lee literally dropped the ball in the end zone. And that kind of spoke to them. Favre had 270 yards passing, had three TDs. Aaron Rodgers had a banner day. He had literally his most successful day in the NFL. He threw for 384 yards, two touchdowns, but one interception.
One interception, called it.
There was also another interesting stat where they were sacked eight times. Aaron Rodgers was sacked eight times. So, and I think if you're not going to protect your quarterback, you're not going to win.
Well, it was all about who's going to get rattled. How did the Vikings protect Brett Favre so he could show off with that lightning arm and win the game?
Well, partly because the Green Bay defensive line was a little bit depleted. But I think in terms of they just created a nice wall around him. And there's also a piece of that where Brett Favre is a veteran quarterback and he knows how to get out of trouble and how to find those passing lanes. But I watched the game with a Green Bay fan and I think I'm a little, you know, my heart is a little...
You're hurting for the Green Bay fan. All right, well, we're all hurting for Leo on our staff, who's a Green Bay fan. He's a Wisconsin fellow on our staff. Finally, Brett Favre is a veteran. He's 40 years old. He's hung around for a long time. But quarterbacks are fragile in a league where the offensive and defensive lines are getting huger and huger, 300-pound men against these much lighter quarterbacks. What's the NFL doing to manage this?
They have a lot of new rules, so you can't hit a quarterback after he has thrown the ball. So what you're seeing a lot of, or like hitting them to the head. There's also rules where you can't do helmet-on-helmet contact, which sounds absurd to some of the other listeners that remember the purple people eaters of the different eras.
The sound of the clashing helmets.
Correct, exactly. That is football. But they're putting in rules to really limit the amount of contact that happens that really rattles people's brains.
Because if the quarterbacks go, there's no game. The NFL is going to like lose their product if they don't protect these quarterbacks.
It's true. The era of the quarterback where you had people like Jim Kelly of the Bills and Dan Marino of the Dolphins, that era of the quarterback is somewhat past, and Brett Favre reminds us of that era. That's why last night was such an interesting game.
But we should not forget that the average career in the NFL is something like 3.5 years.
And most players don't even get into the game. They'll play in the practice squad, and they'll never actually see real game time. So to have a guy that plays – you know, for 20 years, like Brett Favre, he was playing when I was in high school, which is absurd, is an amazing feat in itself.
Is 40 the new 30 in the NFL?
40 is the new 30 because you have a guy like Junior Seau, who's coming back now with the New England Patriots. He's also going to be in his 20th year, and he'll bring a veteran presence into that locker room. You can't take away that veteran presence and that understanding and that wisdom and knowledge of the game.
And, you know, to have a linebacker coming back, that's different than a quarterback who's been protected, you know, has been back there in the pocket. You know, to have a linebacker coming
back,
he's either really desperate or he is truly a man of steel.
Well, they also don't take as much punishment. They deliver the punishment, which is a very different thing.
That's true.
So running backs, they can't stay in the league that long. They're like 2 or 3 years and then they're done. Guy like Junior Seau, he just throws his shoulder in there and the guy bounces back.
What position did you play?
Oh, yeah, I played linebacker.
There we go. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports contributor with your takeout this morning.
Good morning. Final takeout comes from you, the listeners. Yesterday, we told you the story about Tim Smith. He's a gay Marine featured on a Memphis billboard that said, "I'm gay and I protected your freedom." It was put up by Memphis's Gay and Lesbian Community Center in the run-up to the National Coming Out Day on October 11th. That started a serious debate on our website, thetakeaway.org. Zach writes about the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. "I served in the Army for 4 years and have come across soldiers that we thought might be homosexual. They did their jobs just as anyone else, but it becomes a nightmare to try to deal with the issues of having openly gay people serving. Once someone admits to being homosexual, it changes how people look at them and how they're dealt with." And in response to that, Travis writes, "Yes, the military does need to keep in mind how others will react to homosexuals, but I think we need to take the restriction off. If we shelter everyone from the truth about who they serve with, they will never think they know anyone who's gay and never associate gay men with the guys they've served with, and they'll only continue the stereotypes and the bigotry." And then KW had this to say, John.
"Well, it seems that in the U.S., the military is where integration and acceptance of all marginalized groups begins. This is why it needs to be clear that homosexuals are serving with distinction and always have been. This is also why it's been critical that women who want to serve be allowed to serve, and why not giving them equal recognition for equal sacrifice is a big problem. Gay troops in the military weren't on everybody's mind yesterday. We talked about David Letterman's office affairs and the problems when a boss sleeps with a subordinate. Al from Oklahoma City emailed us this. Before we jump to conclusions about workplace exploitation, we might be wise to wait for all the details. It's entirely possible that Letterman in no way forced himself on anyone, and he may have been involved in a totally consensual and mutual relationship with co-workers. In fact, that's our understanding. Granted, it may be risky with subordinates, but at some point, both parties have to take some responsibility," Al from Oklahoma City writes. He emailed us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. You can also try and reach us at 8778-MYTAKE. Either way, you know how to find us. Good morning. Coming up, soldiers of fortune in Afghanistan and the bloody consequences for U.S. troops. That's in a minute. But right now, let's check on top news stories at 32 minutes after the hour. News just in this hour on Director Roman Polanski. Switzerland is denying his request to be released from prison. U.S. authorities want him back in America. He fled decades ago after pleading guilty to having sex with an underage girl. Our partner, the New York Times, reports that doctors are being swamped with calls from patients wanting the new H1N1 or swine flu vaccine. The first dose are reserved for certain high-risk groups.
U.S. Central Commander General David Petraeus is making health news. He's undergone successful treatment for prostate cancer. The general was diagnosed with early-stage cancer in February. He received 2 months of radiation treatment in Washington. In tech news, the Federal Trade Commission is set to regulate blogging. Under new rules, bloggers will be required to disclose freebies or payments they get from companies for reviewing products. And the National Retail Federation is predicting a 1% decline in retail sales for November and December. Heating prices are expected to rise, though, this winter. An upcoming government report is expected to show a double-digit drop for national gas and propane. The heating prices are going to fall this winter. Rescuers in western Indonesia are trying to get some of the most remote communities. American troops are helping out. U.S. Navy Rear Admiral Richard Landolt explains what they're doing there.
We have 2 to 3 ships coming in with helicopter support. They'll also be able to transport medical supplies and water to those outlying areas.
The final death toll in Indonesia is expected to be in the thousands. And big science news out just this morning. 3 researchers are sharing the Nobel Prize in Physics for work on fiber optics and semiconductors. And today, President Obama meets with 30 members of Congress to talk about strategy in Afghanistan and Pakistan. It's part of a series of meetings the president is having. The White House is weighing a request for more troops in Afghanistan. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Many meetings, but no decision on strategy yet. It is expected. The president met with Defense Secretary Robert Gates yesterday to talk about Afghanistan. Here he is speaking on CNN.
The reality is that because of our inability and the inability, frankly, of our allies to put enough troops into Afghanistan, the Taliban do have the momentum right now, it seems.
The extent to which the Taliban do have the momentum in Afghanistan was demonstrated very, very bloodily and visibly to the rest of the world in an attack over the weekend in which 8 soldiers died. More on that in just a moment. But we are beginning our coverage this week of the passing of a milestone in Afghanistan, 8 years since that war began. That passes tomorrow. It'll be 8 years since U.S. troops invaded Afghanistan along with NATO forces to roll back the Taliban and al-Qaeda forces. Yesterday, we spoke with Major T.G. Taylor, who's a Brigade Task Force Mountain Warrior, part of the International Security Assistance Force, ISAF, in Jalalabad, eastern Afghanistan. He talked about what happened last Saturday in which Taliban or forces overwhelmed a U.S. military outpost in the Nuristan province of Afghanistan. 8 U.S. soldiers were left dead, many more wounded. I first asked the Major to describe the events on the ground as he understood them.
In the early morning hours of Saturday, local militia fighters in Nuristan province took over a mosque in the Kandesh district near ISAF combat outpost. From the mosque, they then attacked the outpost, but ISAF soldiers, along with their Afghan counterparts, were able to repel the attack.
Now, you know, we were under the understanding, and there were early reports that suggested that the Taliban were behind this attack. But if this is a attack by local militia, first of all, how unusual is that? And are local militia behaving as though the U.S. is more of an occupation force than a nation-building force, as the campaign at least originally has been described?
Well, I can tell you when I say a local militia force, it's not necessarily an organization like we might think of in the United States where they might have a card or a website or something like that. A local militia means generally they're local people who have picked up arms. And generally speaking, local fighters will, you know, if paid to do so, would pick up arms. You know, this is a very poor country, and in some places, you know, people will do whatever is required to put food on their tables. I wouldn't necessarily refute claims that this was connected in some way to Taliban or al-Qaeda at some very, very high level. What I can tell you is that our troops on the ground saw local fighters.
You know, this is not the first time that one of these isolated outposts has been attacked. There have been other deadly attacks on these places, and General Stanley McChrystal wants to pull the U.S. forces back to the larger population areas, to the larger cities. I'm wondering if you agree with that proposal from General McChrystal. Is it impossible to keep our U.S. soldiers safe in these isolated areas?
I can tell you that General McChrystal's idea has nothing to do with keeping soldiers safe in those outposts. It has nothing to do with that. What it is it's about counterinsurgency doctrine. Counterinsurgency doctrine calls for soldiers to secure population areas so that we can build the will of the people to defeat the insurgency and separate the people from the insurgents and connect the people with their government.
But, Major, the one problem with that is if you're following the counterinsurgency doctrine and local fighters are simply able to be paid to turn and become al-Qaeda fighters to attack this outpost with such grim results, it means the sort of hearts and minds battle is really, really difficult, no matter what you do with the troops.
Well, I can tell you that winning people over, which is what we need to do here, is win people over. It's hard no matter where you are. There is a culture which connects to, in some ways, to Taliban. They understand the thinking that Taliban have. They have a common religion.
Major, I hear a certain amount of frustration in your voice, and I totally agree with what you're saying there. I'm just wondering, you know, given this debate that's going on in the United States about what to do next in Afghanistan, what tools do you need to separate those local people from the insurgents?
What we need to do is to have our soldiers make moves to be able to better protect the population.
And do you feel you're better able to do that with more troops?
I couldn't comment one way or another. I could tell you that in the population centers in our area, we have had very good success so far in areas such as Jalalabad. you know, and we're spreading that success, starting building from a place of strength in a successful city like Jalalabad, and spreading that into the less populated areas from there.
Well, there is a sobering takeaway. 8 years after sending the first troops to Afghanistan, apparently local militia are merely a paycheck away from turning on U.S. and NATO forces. That's Major T.G. Taylor, deployed with Task Force Mountain Warrior, part of ISAF force in Jalalabad, eastern Afghanistan, about 40 miles from the outpost, attacked on Saturday. 8 soldiers died, the bloodiest single day of combat in the war so far. Thanks for being with us.
We are hearing stories from all across the country about Afghanistan this week. We're taking more takes on the war and how its progress, how its mission is affecting you in your homes. And we want to hear your stories. Have you served overseas, or is a loved one serving? Or maybe you're one of the protesters, such as we have in Washington today. Let us know what your story is, 8778-MY-TAKE, or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Coming up in just a moment, we've been in the middle of a long recession, and it seems that the recession has affected office politics and the relationships between employees. Stay with us. We're going to talk about that.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlery. And this is what you might have heard on Saturday at the No. 1 Ladies Opera House in Botswana. That chamber opera and the new opera house where they're singing in it is the brainchild of Alexander McCall Smith. Many people probably know him already as the best-selling author of No. 1 Ladies Detective Agency series that is set in Botswana. We're here now with Alexander McCall Smith. So, Mr. Smith, why did you want to open up an opera house in Botswana's capital?
Well, people are very keen on singing in Botswana. There are many amateur choirs, and people take great pleasure in singing on all sorts of occasions. And they've got some very good singers. And so I thought it would be rather nice to set up a little opera house, which from time to time would put on operas to allow these local singers to have a shot at opera.
Now, this is not exactly grand opera. There's 70 seats, right?
That's a really squashed, probably 50 in comfort, 70 in some discomfort. It's very small.
And we're talking about a place that was a garage. It was originally a waiting room for miners going off to mine diamonds in South Africa. And then it became a garage fixing cars, and now it's an opera house.
Yes, we changed it from being a garage into an opera house. It's a lovely spot. It's a very beautiful spot just outside the capital city, Gaborone, in Botswana. And there's a lovely view of the hills and the surrounding countryside. It's very, very nice. It's a very small-scale project, but I think it really works.
And I read that you wanted it to remain small-scale. You don't have any ambitions to let this grow into something big.
Well, you know, we're waiting for a call from the Met, but they haven't phoned yet. So if you could pass on any calls you get from them.
Well, in a few hours, we could just transfer you over there, you know.
So this very first opera that you're doing is Macbeth in a baboon colony.
Yes, it's an opera called The Okavango Macbeth. And it's really set amongst a troop of baboons in Botswana, and it shows how baboons, because of their concern with status and dominance, have Macbeth issues. There's a Lady Macbeth figure in the baboon colony or troop. So it really shows how some of the features of baboon life are also to be found in human life.
And it premiered last weekend?
Yes, we had the world premiere on Saturday here in Botswana, in Gaborone, and I must say it was a lovely experience. It was a joyful experience. The young singers who took part in it really enjoyed themselves, and they performed magnificently.
Now, are you singing in baboon, or is it translated into English?
It's in English. Baboons are actually quite good linguists, and you'll find that you can write for them in any language in there, and it seems all right.
Were there 50 comfortable people at the premiere, or 70 squashed ones?
I think we were probably in between, probably about 60, and people were so enjoying themselves that discomfort didn't matter too much. It was a wonderful performance.
Okay, so quickly, what's the next opera?
I don't know. I don't think it's going to be Hamlet set amongst the dolphins, but nothing quite like that. We'll wait and see.
Alexander McCall Smith is the best-selling author of the No. 1 Ladies Detective Agency series. He's just opened a new art center in Botswana's capital called the No. 1 Ladies Opera House.
It's not over till the baboon, the lady baboon sings.
The fat lady baboon.
You will see things that break the heart.
Good morning, I'm Celeste Headley here with John Hockenberry. And John, if every day after the show I wandered into our executive producer's office and badmouthed you so that they'd fire you and I could take, this could be the Celeste Headley show.
Wouldn't make any difference. I've already nailed you. I've already got the knife in your back.
Well, that's nice to know, but actually it was rhetorical. I was saying it's an example of what's been going on more and more during the recession.
In public radio.
We're going to be talking about the dog-eat-dog world of recession office politics in just a moment. First, here's a check on leading stories at 48 minutes after the hour. The first doses of the H1N1 or swine flu vaccine are out this week. Our partner, the New York Times, reports doctors are being swamped with calls from patients who want it. Right now, supplies are limited, so healthcare workers are first in line to get it.
Looking ahead now, overseas Chinese Premier Wen Jiabao has left North Korea after an important meeting with leader Kim Jong-il. North Korean state media say the country may now be willing to return to nuclear talks. More now from John Sudworth from our partner the BBC reporting from Seoul.
Wen Jiabao's three-day trip to Pyongyang began with a hug at the airport from Kim Jong-il himself, a rare honor for a non-head of state. It ended with something much more important, the assurance that China was looking for that its isolated neighbour is willing to return to the multilateral nuclear disarmament negotiations known as the Six-Party Talks. But the North Korean leader is reported to have told his Chinese visitor that such a move would depend on the outcome of direct talks with Washington, something Pyongyang has been pushing for in recent months. Earlier this year, after the United Nations' condemnation of its nuclear test, North Korea said it was walking away from the multilateral talks for good. It is thought to prefer bilateral negotiations as an easier way to win diplomatic normalization and a lifting of sanctions. If Washington agrees to such a meeting, and even if North Korea can then be persuaded to return to the six-party talks, the participants may find themselves back to square one.
Looking ahead to nuclear talks in North Korea, that was John Sudworth with our partner, the BBC, reporting from Seoul. And those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
It's Tuesday. That means we're talking about work here on The Takeaway. And today we're talking about ugly workplaces. We're joined by Beth Kobliner, author of Get a Financial Life, Personal Finance in Your 20s and 30s. And Beth, here's something we got from Amanda, who lives in New York.
In the past year, I've worked in two restaurants and at one office job. While at the office job, the company basically stopped paying the employees, which, as you can imagine, caused a pretty awful work environment. The owners refused to talk about it or give us any details on when the situation would change, and that obviously left all the employees to chatter amongst ourselves. It was really difficult when we would find out someone else got paid and we knew that we didn't. They made it hard to leave because, you know, it's difficult to find a job these days, and I ended up leaving just because of the environment. But in the restaurant business, it was especially difficult because when it was really slow when you were coming into a new environment, managers already had their favorites, and there were times when I would come into work and be sent home.
Wow, that's ugly.
Yeah, she went from one ugly workplace into another ugly workplace. Is this happening more now that people are being laid off, now that salaries are being cut? Are people backstabbing one another to try to save their own jobs?
You know, Celeste, since cavemen have gone out to slay the wild boar, you know, since whenever you have two guys and one leader, there's been workplace politics. There's backbiting, sucking up, taking credit, and we're seeing it more and more. In fact, a recent poll found, in fact, that we're seeing people are saying 4 out of 10 employees are now encountering more workplace politicking, backstabbing going on because of the recession, because people are desperate. You know, if you're afraid you're going to lose your job and you're feeling threatened, then you're more likely to try to maneuver your way around it so that you kind of get ahead and look better in the eyes of your employer.
So Will Markham is also with us, a former GM assembly plant worker and member of the UAW. We've heard from Will several times.
Our buddy Will Markham, yes, indeed.
He's worked at this GM plant for 20 years. And Will, the plant closed down last week. And I'm wondering, as you were leading up to the plant closing, what was the environment like among the employees?
Well, there was a lot of rumors, you know. Of course, you got the rumor mill, and being there were so many decisions being made well above us, outside the local. You know, we had an information kind of blackout, so left a lot of room for the rumors. And, of course, people were trying to get reassigned at other locations. A lot of people, a couple people got assigned to Kansas. Their families are still here, you know, and they uprooted and went and, you know, that's not a place you can drive back every weekend. So, you know, their families are still here and they're in Kansas. So it was really, there was a lot of backbiting, a lot of competition, and it was over jobs that weren't exactly great, admirable situations to be in.
So, Beth, you hear what he's talking about from Pontiac, Michigan. When people know that they're going to get laid off and they're trying to scramble for maybe the few positions that they can get, I imagine it gets worse.
It does get worse. And I think the one thing that's come out of this, which I think is an interesting perspective, is there might be an opportunity here. And bear with me for a minute. I think because of the recession, you're looking at me skeptically, but because of the recession, I think there's an opportunity here to embrace our inner Machiavelli in the sense that you need to be astute. You need to kind of, I think the lesson is that when people are laid off and you're left in the workplace, you know, if you're in a situation where you're a remaining worker, you have to learn the office politics. I was never good at this personally, but you need to know who's your boss, who's under your boss, who's your boss's boss, because, you know, a poll found by the Center for Creative Leadership that 66% of employees say that people in their organization are demoted, fired, or passed up for promotion because they lack political skill. And I think the lesson there is you need to kind of, you know, you don't have to be part of the backstabbing, but you need to understand the politics to kind of maneuver your way in this particularly tough time. Well, it's the sad reality.
Embrace the inner Machiavelli. It raises a moral issue. Will Markham, here's a question from your buddy John Hockenberry. What wouldn't you do to save your job, Will Markham? I mean, what stab would you not do? What meeting would you not have? What dishonesty would you not engage in to hold on to your job if it was a matter of desperation?
Well, that's good. You're tough. That was a tough one. There's a lot of things I wouldn't do. I mean, I had a situation last week where I could have advanced myself over someone else, and I turned that down. You know what I mean? That's unfortunately, I mean, I guess you got to get used to it, but unfortunately, you know, we can all talk politics, we can talk this and that, but 9 times out of 10, politics, not the best person's going to be promoted. Mm-hmm. And there's, I think, is what's killing America and killing the workforce right now. Is it's wonderful to have a lot of friends, it's wonderful to politic and feel accepted. But at the end of the day, it's a competitive workplace. We're in a new world market, and we need our best to be promoted and moved up. And I'm afraid with politics and that kind of backbiting, that very seldom happens.
Well, you can hear in his voice. You can hear in his voice what's driving this.
It's really difficult. I'm not saying, I mean, I think it's sort of flipped to say inner Machiavelli, but I think when you flip it around, you know, poll after poll shows that employers want workers who have good interpersonal skills, who are good at getting along with others, the quote-unquote team player. And I think it's sort of a shift in what we need to do in terms of being quote-unquote successful in the workplace, that you have to kind of get along. And I think it's tough for people who just kind of keep their head down and try to get their work done. That mode doesn't seem to work in this current work environment where it is so dog-eat-dog.
So Will, you're actually, we're a union leader at the plant. And from what I understand, although a lot of the managers got reassigned, 90% of the line workers were laid off. So how did you keep the workers from eating each other alive?
We just kept our ears to the ground. We've got a lot of people on temporary assignments where it may only be for the next 3 to 6 months, but we were able to at least get people into temporary assignments to hopefully buy time to find other locations. I mean, it's right now it's like musical chairs, and when the music stops, there's not enough chairs to go around.
Whoa.
So it makes it very difficult, you know. And I agree 100% with what's being said about we as a workforce have to learn to work with one another and be more competitive, and you know, that is very important. But I just hope that, you know, the things that built this country was our initiative and our individuality, and I just hope that doesn't get washed away in the process.
Will Markham, former GM assembly plant worker from Pontiac, Michigan, and also Beth Koblenzer, Takeaway contributor. He's also author of Get a Financial Life, Personal Finance for Your 20s and 30s.
All right, we want to know from you, has your workplace gotten worse since the recession? Has financial stress in the office turned into more sniping and fighting and difficult office politics with your coworkers? Tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. And we still want to continue hearing your stories about Afghanistan. The fight there has lasted for 8 years, and all this week we want to bring you different viewpoints on the war in Afghanistan and its progress. How has it affected you? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. Eight years in Afghanistan, eight more names on a memorial wall in Fort Carson, Colorado.
They say time heals, but it's just hard. It's just the hardest thing I've ever been through.
The names inscribed on these stones are an example of the greatness of our nation. All ranks, backgrounds, colors, face, yet one common thread. They are soldiers, American soldiers.
To go waltzing Matilda, waltzing Matilda.
As the U.S. war in Afghanistan approaches the milestone of being the longest war in this nation's history, we peer through the eyes of some fighting men.
I'm an innocent victim of a blinded alley.
The sacrifices of the 4th Brigade, 4th ID, and tallying the cost of another surge in Afghanistan. Doing the difficult math on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Tuesday, October 6th. I'm John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, John. This hour, minority communities are saying enough is enough already. Take a listen to what we have to say about the healthcare debate. We're going to get their perspective, and we'll go inside the debate that's pitting free speech advocates against animal rights advocates. The Supreme Court is going to decide who wins that battle.
But first, let's talk to retired Sergeant Major Terrence McWilliams. He was the highest-ranking enlisted man at Fort Carson from 2002 to 2007. Eight more names are going on Fort Carson's memorial wall as of last Saturday's attack in Afghanistan. Sergeant Major, how does your community react to something like this?
Well, our community is grieving just as the families are grieving. This is a terrible tragedy, and we really feel the pain that the families are going through right now because of the close-knit community ties that we have with the military.
Sergeant Major Terrence McWilliams, stay with us. We're going to talk about the resilience of your community when we come back to you in just a moment. But right now, everything else you need to know this morning.
In the headlines, President Obama is getting more advice on how to handle Afghanistan and Pakistan. This time, it's from 30 members of Congress. He's meeting with them at the White House today. And this is as the Pentagon is creating two new units for the Afghan war. The Wall Street Journal reports their mission includes helping U.S. troops understand how Afghanistan's political and tribal systems work.
Switzerland is denying Director Roman Polanski's request to be released from prison. He faces possible extradition to the U.S., and Swiss authorities worry he might try to run. Polanski fled the U.S. decades ago after pleading guilty to having sex with an underage girl. North Korea says it may be willing to return to international nuclear talks. State media report that Kim Jong-il made this announcement to China's premier. Wall Street gained around 1% yesterday. It begins trading. Dow begins trading at 9,600. The S&P starts trading at 1040, and the Nasdaq begins at 2068. Futures trading suggests a positive opening when Wall Street gets underway a little under 30 minutes from now. America's fight in Afghanistan, as we mentioned, has lasted for 8 years as of tomorrow. For many, it's been a long road, especially if you've served or have a loved one who's serving. All week long, we're to have different viewpoints on the war in Afghanistan, and we want to hear your viewpoint, your stories, your personal connection to this conflict, which could become America's longest war. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning, everyone. Capturing the experience of war, it's always a challenge for journalists, for storytellers.
It's too broad. I mean, it's too. There's too much there.
Yeah. One time, someone told me, a journalist told me that journalists fight to get to the center of the action when they're war correspondents. But what you eventually understand is that war is happening everywhere at once. At the end of the epic 3-hour movie, The Longest Day, one of the most famous movies about World War II, it's a heroic treatment of a war whose mission couldn't have been more clear, where the winners couldn't have been more on the side of the angels. The filmmakers sum up the whole experience of World War II in the voices of these two wounded, lost soldiers.
I haven't fired my gun all day. I keep hearing shooting, but every time I get there, everybody's gone.
It's funny, isn't it? He's dead, I'm crippled, you're lost. I suppose it's always like that. I mean, war.
I wonder who won.
I wonder who won. If those kinds of questions were raised about World War II in that movie, consider the conflict in Afghanistan. As of tomorrow, it turns 8 years, and sometime next year it will become the longest war in U.S. history if we're still in Afghanistan. We want to know most how it's affected you.
This is Mark from Cape Cod. We're hosting a young man from Afghanistan, a high school student who's 16 this year and perhaps for the next 3 years of his high school education. And I'll tell you, his perspective on what we're doing over in Afghanistan is a lot different than what I'm hearing on the radio and reading in the paper. Seems like maybe Mr. Obama should be sending in more teachers and more instructors for police and military, and perhaps we should be paying those militias to turn our way instead of toward the Taliban.
Well, tell us your story. Has your family been serving? Have you been protesting? Where should we be this time next year in Afghanistan? All week long, we're covering the war in Afghanistan as it turns 8 years, the conflict of the U.S. troops in Afghanistan. Now, the conflict as seen through the eyes of one community whose sacrifices are quite literally difficult to fathom. The 4th Infantry Division's 4th Brigade is based out of Fort Carson, Colorado, near Colorado Springs. The combat unit lost 8 men, as we mentioned, on Saturday after an attack by insurgents in eastern Afghanistan. They all came from Fort Carson. In both Iraq and Afghanistan, the post has lost, listen to this, more than 270 soldiers. We're rejoined now by Sergeant Major Terrence McWilliams, the highest-ranking enlisted man at Fort Carson. He served as the commander there for 5.5 years before retiring in 2007. Sergeant Major, 270 soldiers. I mean, it seems as though Fort Carson really makes the point that certain communities are paying for this war while other communities are mere spectators to what's going on in Afghanistan, in Iraq. Would you go along with that?
I wouldn't necessarily go along with that, but say that all communities that have a military installation in it are feeling the pain of the hardships of war.
And the hardships of war in the community of Colorado Springs is something that Tom Roeder covers every day. He's a military correspondent for the Gazette in Colorado Springs. This is a daily story for you in Colorado Springs, right, Tom?
It's one that's been repeated far too many times for this town. Watching the newspaper I work for has covered each one of these deaths that you mentioned as an individual story, where we look into the lives of these men who lost their lives, and women in some cases.
And, you know, I was looking online. There's so much video from Fort Carson, Colorado, of homecomings, joyous homecomings, but also each family posting their memorials of the individuals who have died. I mean, I was looking, and there was a memorial when there were only 46 names on that wall, then 57 names on that wall at Fort Carson, where they have the memorials of all the soldiers who have died. It's now up to, you know, it's up to 270, and they're going to add 8 more names. How do you cover that story without just making a ghoulish reiteration of the consequences of this war?
That's a good question. I don't know if I have a good answer for that at this point. But what we do is we tell the stories of the lives of these young people who've gone to war. In a lot of cases, you wind up saying why this kid went to war, what their motivation was. You also get to explain, especially in the case of the 8 gentlemen that died this weekend, how they died and the kind of fight they were in. And from what we're hearing, that was some pretty serious bravery that went on that hill in Afghanistan.
Are the reasons people are joining up different now than they were, say, 8 years ago? And I understand that Fort Carson is just learning about Afghanistan now, that really for the longest time it was Iraq for you folks.
Absolutely. Well, early on, right after 2001, there was a patriotic swell in the country. that really drove people to the colors, and it was almost like a World War II sort of scene where you had people signing up for patriotic reasons. The folks who are coming into the Army are doing it with their eyes wide open right now. They know that they will be sent to war in Iraq or Afghanistan. Their motivations vary from economic to patriotic, but they're there. That's a pretty amazing group of folks when you look at, you know, would you jump in right now knowing that you're going to face the risks these men and women do?
And apparently they do. And, of course, the trauma for this community isn't confined to the people who are directly serving. Here's a 23-year-old barista named Alexander who spoke with one of our producers yesterday about the impacts that he sees every day.
I don't know. A lot of the veterans I've met, I've known six. And out of the six, two have committed suicide. One, well, I don't really know how to explain him. He's on more pills than I've ever seen anybody on, even somebody in their late 90s with health issues.
Sergeant Major Terrence McWilliams, can you relate to that story being told by someone that, you know, whether they survive or not, they're certainly coming back into the community with serious health and mental problems?
Well, you know, no one can really explain unless you've actually been there and experienced the traumas that war have on the effect of an individual. These are brave men and women that I have the highest respect for because, again, they volunteered. They volunteered during a time where they knew that we are at war. And I would tell you that not only the military, but the community as well is doing everything that they humanly can do with the resources that are available to provide the assistance that these troops desperately need.
Well, Sergeant Major Terrence McWilliams, you are a director of military support for the El Palmar Foundation in Colorado Springs, Colorado. And we're also talking with Tom Roeder, military reporter for the Gazette in Colorado Springs.
Sergeant Major, are these soldiers who are coming home with mental health issues, are they being taken care of properly?
Yes. In my opinion, we are doing everything we can to properly identify and treat and take care and assist all these soldiers.
You know, I want to ask both of you before we go, Tom Roeder, military reporter for the Gazette in Colorado Springs, and Sergeant Major Terrence McWilliams, what do you believe the mission is in Afghanistan as far as you can understand it? Tom Roeder?
That's a pretty deep question. The mission is for the military is clearly to go fight and win over there. The big question is what fighting and winning is going to entail. What we're going to see is a new strategy to try to accomplish that mission. The soldiers of the 4th Brigade Combat Team were being pulled out of these remote outposts where that fighting was over the weekend. They're going to be closer to the population in cities, and we're going to see if they can lock down security in those cities to begin to give that population some sense of security where they can start rebuilding their economy, and hopefully we'll have people turning away from the insurgency as that goes on.
Well, Tom Roeder, military reporter for the Gazette in Colorado Springs, I'm sure we're going to come back to you. Thanks so much for being with us. Retired Sergeant Major Terrence McWilliams, highest-ranking enlisted man at Fort Carson from 2002 to 2007. What's your understanding of the mission in Afghanistan? Do you get it?
Well, Tom Roeder summed it up in his comments. But again, we are there to assist the people of Afghanistan, to help them, you know, help stabilize their country so they can be self-sufficient.
And we will have been doing that for 8 years as of tomorrow. Our thanks to both Sergeant Major Terrence McWilliams and Tom Roeder. 270 plus 8 fatalities from the 4th Brigade, 4th Infantry Division base at Fort Carson, Colorado. Just a slice of the casualties in Afghanistan 8 years into this war. All this week, we're going to bring you different takes on the war in Afghanistan, its progress, but mostly we want to know how this war, which could become America's longest war, how it's affected you. Tell us your story.
I'm calling from Detroit. I'm a professor here at the university, and my experience with this war in Afghanistan is teaching an increasing number of students who are out of the military or on leave and taking Middle Eastern studies courses. And the resounding message from them is the lack of preparation that they've had going into Iraq or Afghanistan.
What's your story? Have you been protesting? Do you notice anything about people who are serving in Afghanistan, either on their way over or on their way home? Where should we be this time next year? The war in Afghanistan turns 8 tomorrow. What's your take? 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Hey, you want that to go?
Okay, some quick takeouts on stories we want you to be on top of this week. Todd Zwillick begins, Takeaway's Washington correspondent. So they're heading up to the White House today to talk about Afghanistan, but I suspect, Todd, they're not going to be commemorating 8 years of war in Afghanistan. It's something a little more forward-looking, right?
Yeah, hardly. Yeah, you're right, John. Bipartisan leaders in Congress on the leadership front and on military affairs. So you have Speaker Pelosi, John Boehner, the Republican leader in the House, Harry Reid, of course, and Mitch McConnell in the Senate, John Kerry, and all of the foreign relations and military leaders in the Senate, including John McCain, by the way, heading to the White House. And you mentioned a few minutes ago that, or Celeste mentioned that Robert Gibbs says the president wants to hear from all sides and from Democrats and Republicans. I'm sure that that's true, but just as important, I think they want to hear from him because, of course, military leaders, the brass at the Pentagon and officials at the White House have been waging an unusually public debate over Afghanistan, whether to have a sort of a small focused counterterrorism strategy or a broader counterinsurgency strategy versus the Taliban. The Republicans like McCain and Lindsey Graham are clear. They want a broad counterinsurgency strategy. Some of the officials in the White House have said the opposite. There's been a public debate, and I think these leaders want to hear from the president what he is thinking, not this cat scratch game that's going on between the brass and the White House.
You know, Todd, I don't want to spend too much time on the analysis side of your brain, much as I love it. I'm wondering, after Bob Schieffer accuses the administration of dithering over the weekend on Afghanistan, if this isn't a risky meeting for the president to be having right now, that it's going to look like more dithering.
Well, it may. That's a risk, I'm sure, and it may do the opposite. If the president gets everyone in one room and says, this is what I'm thinking, we're not dithering, this is where we're headed, we'll have an announcement in 2 weeks, that can be reassuring to lawmakers.
All right, well, this perfectly sets up the defense bill, which, of course, is the major stage in Congress for talking about earmarks. That's already underway, right?
Yeah, they're trying to wrap that up, John. $626 billion in defense appropriations. Now, this is actually Congress writing the check for the Pentagon and for the wars. And, you know, there's a fight over earmarks every year. Speaking of Senator John McCain, he's been absolutely furious about a program in this bill for this, you know, the C-17, the giant hulking tanker aircraft?
Sure.
Big four-engine aircraft. $2.5 billion in this bill for 10 C-17s that the Pentagon doesn't want. They say they don't want them. The White House isn't particularly interested, but they remain in the bill. Listen to McCain talking about this.
Despite what I think is going to happen, I believe that if the president wants to send a message that we're serious about cutting out wasteful and unnecessary and corrupting spending in Congress, he should veto this bill, and we could send it back to him in a New York minute without the pork in it that it is so rife and full of.
Hey, well, we'll refresh out of New York minutes here, Todd. That sounds a hopping mad by John McCain. Thanks so much. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent.
Now to Louise Story, the finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times. You know, the finances are often as difficult to predict as the weather, but Louise, you did it. You said that they were going to do something for people who could afford to pay their mortgage but had lost their job, and it looks like that's happened, right?
It does. I don't have a crystal ball, but I have put my ear to the ground down here in Washington, and bank lobbyists were telling me that people who are unemployed need help with their mortgages. And yesterday, Barney Frank, who you know is a very powerful lawmaker in the House, said that he's going to push for $2 billion of the money we've gotten back from the banks to be used to help people who are unemployed not be foreclosed on. So it's pretty big news.
And that's very different from what we've had before, which focused on new home buyers, right? And mortgage modification.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. I mean, in the past, you had to show you were going to have an income to get help on your mortgage. And the problem is more and more people don't have incomes. More and more people are losing their jobs. And so this is a bit of a realization, too, on the part of lawmakers that, look, we got to think about these unemployed people a little more carefully. We're seeing signs from the White House that they may provide more assistance for unemployed people because the problem's dragging on.
So we also saw a rally in stocks for U.S. banks yesterday. Some people were surprised by that. What caused that?
Well, you know, Goldman Sachs put out a report, and, you know, anything coming out of Goldman has a kind of golden glow. And they said that they think there's going to be a dramatic improvement in bank earnings power. And remember, when you hear this now, on the one hand, you should feel kind of happy because we own these banks. You know, we own stock in Bank of America and Wells Fargo. Those are two of the banks that Goldman Sachs are going to...
said literally we.
The taxpayers. Yeah, literally we. That's what I mean. Literally we. We own them. And we rescued them. So on the one hand, you should feel happy when you see that their earnings are improving. But on the other hand, you've got to wonder, are they improving because they're going to rip people off? Are they going to rip consumers off to make these better earnings? So I don't know.
That's a very serious other hand. Louise Story, thank you, finance reporter for The New York Times.
I love how Louise makes me feel like a bank executive when we talk with her. Now our final takeout comes from Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway sports contributor. And, you know, they had to delay a baseball playoff last night so Brett Favre could put on a show on the Monday Night Football game, beating the Green Bay Packers there in Minnesota. But tonight... it's the Detroit Tigers versus the Minnesota Twins, win or die, right?
It is the definition of win or go home, for sure.
Exactly.
And it's going to probably be another shootout similar to what you saw last night because the starting pitching for both teams is a little bit shaky. And that gives the edge to the Twins, who have a guy named Joe Mauer, who has 364 batting average, the best in the league right now. 96 RBIs, 28 home runs, he's dangerous. And they also have a lot of other power in their lineup.
So you say, even though these teams are 86 and 76, that they have the exact same record, that this is going to be all about offense, not about pitching.
Right now, the Twins actually hold the series lead against each other.
That's why it's in Minnesota, right?
Correct, yep. Exactly. So I think that I'm giving the edge to Minnesota, and Minnesota, the Metrodome is going to have a great party 2 days in a row.
Celeste is not going to like
that.
Well,
you know, unfortunately, the same thing happened last year, did it not?
It was the Twins that ended up playing against Chicago, and they lost
1-0.
The White
Sox, and they
lost, exactly.
Right. So hopefully that'll happen again.
Exactly.
Well, you know, is this a moot point, though? I mean, are we making much of a game that is just truly moot because the winner of this game goes to play the Yankees with the best record in baseball, who are on an absolute hot streak or are going to make mincemeat of anyone in the American League Central Division. That's the theory.
The four keys I have for the playoffs are who can play small ball, which means who can manufacture runs with speed, who has good starting pitching, who has a good strong bullpen, and power clutch hitting. So when you look at the Yankees, they have literally 243 home runs. That's the most by a team in a season. And they also have 40 bullpen wins, which is the most bullpen wins this year in the major leagues. So the Yankees have the edge in that series against whomever they play.
So it'll either be the Minnesota Twins or the Detroit Tigers against the Yankees.
Correct.
Quickly, the other teams in the playoffs.
So the Boston Red Sox are playing Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim. The Colorado in the National League, the Colorado Rockies are going to go against the Philadelphia Phillies. Phillies have the closer Brad Lidge, who last year was perfect closing games. This year he's blown 11 saves, correct. And then finally you have St. Louis Cardinals, who have amazing starting pitching against the Los Angeles Dodgers, who have five players who've been in the World Series before.
Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway sports contributor, thanks for joining us. Coming up, how do you get your voice heard in the healthcare debate?
Coming up, how do we bridge the gap between the healthcare that whites are getting and the healthcare that minorities are getting? That's coming up in a moment. Right now, though, let's check in on the top news stories at 32 minutes after the hour. Speaking of healthcare, our partner, the New York Times, reports that requests for the H1N1 or swine flu vaccine are flooding doctors' offices. Early doses of the vaccine are out this week, but they're reserved for high-risk groups. And in Washington, President Obama will meet with members of Congress to discuss strategy for Afghanistan and Pakistan today. The president is considering a request for more troops in Afghanistan.
In Pakistan, the Taliban now claims responsibility for yesterday's attack on a UN food program building. Five people died in Islamabad. This winter's heating bills should be lower for many Americans. That's according to a government report just out this morning. It cites lower fuel costs and a mild forecast. The stock market is open on Wall Street, and is rallying as expected on other economic news. Australia is raising interest rates. That's the first hike by a major country since the financial meltdown. And finally, three scientists whose research paved the way for digital photography and fast communication are the latest winners of the Nobel Prize for Physics. Some of the stories we're following this morning.
Well, the research has been around for years. We do know that there's a difference between the health care that's going to white communities as opposed to that that's going to the communities of African Americans and Latinos in the United States. The health outcomes for different races differs among the races and cultures and even socioeconomic status. So as the Senate Finance Committee moves toward a vote on health care, African American and Latino organizations are trying to make sure that their voices are heard in this debate.
The year I was born, they tried to reform health care. And now I'm 65 years old and it still hasn't happened. But now we can make this real. I'm not going to let special interests and politicians throw 46 million of us under the bus.
Cuando nací, trataron de reformar el sistema de salud. Those are both ads from Health Equity for All. They're going to initially run in four states with large African American and Hispanic populations: Florida, North Carolina, Louisiana, and Arkansas. Health Equity for All is an umbrella organization. It includes the NAACP, La Raza, and lots of other groups. We're joined this morning by Deepak Bhargava. He's the executive director of the Center for Community Change, a grassroots organization dedicated to helping low-income people, especially people of color. And also Dr. Herbert Smitherman. Smitherman is the Assistant Dean of Community and Urban Health at Wayne State University School of Medicine. Let me start with you, Dr. Smitherman. Have we established conclusively that race and health care are related?
Yes. If you look at sort of health care disparities, actually the definition is population-specific differences in the presence of either disease or health outcomes or access to health care. And the health care literature has numerous studies which show that healthcare services, healthcare resources, healthcare outcomes, and care and quality in the United States are not equally distributed, and clearly the studies show that racial and ethnic minorities receive a disproportionately less amount of these services, and most likely it contributes to nearly probably a 7 to 10 year gap in life expectancy between African Americans and Latinos and those of European or in the white community in this country.
So Deepak Bhargava, for me, I mean, I know coming out of a minority family and background, healthcare for many people in minority communities is a racial issue. It's a civil rights issue. And people are very passionate about it in minority communities. Why are we only now hearing about this in the healthcare debate?
Well, I think the truth of the matter is that we've seen major engagement and mobilization from people in communities all over the country, particularly communities of color. But the media has been much more focused on the teabaggers and people going to town hall meetings with guns. So our effort over these last couple of days has been really to elevate this work that's been done and to turn up the heat to make sure that the policy that comes out of Congress ultimately will address the disparities that we just heard about.
And this particular ad campaign that we're seeing coming out of Health Equity for All is, in some cases, is actually naming specific senators. Why are you're talking about to Senator Blanche Lincoln from Arkansas, Senator George Lemieux from Florida, Kay Hagan out of North Carolina, and Louisiana also targeted as well. Why those four?
Well, we're focusing our efforts on senators who are kind of on the fence, who are moderates, who will play a really key role in how this debate unfolds. These moderates come from states that have very large numbers of African Americans and Latinos, and our view is that if their constituents are engaged and aware and participating, that those senators are going to have to turn around to do the right thing, that they won't be able to run and duck and hide.
Dr. Smitherman, is a public option the only way, in your view, to address the issues of racial inequalities and ethnic inequalities of healthcare delivery in the United States?
Well, first of all, we have 47 million people without health insurance, and if you look at the distribution, African Americans represent about 23% of that, the Latino community 34%, and the white community about 10%. So there clearly is a stark disparity between those who are uninsured in minority communities versus those in the European American community. And so if you're talking about interventions, for this population, if you look at the H.R. 3200 bill, it actually does things like expand Medicaid up to 133% poverty, and the public option establishes for Americans between the incomes of 133% and 400% of federal poverty level. It establishes affordable health care with federal subsidies. And if you cover people up to 400% of the federal poverty level, you will capture greater than 95% of the uninsured. So, yes, the impact of the public option will be tremendous on minority communities. So it is an important tool. The Baucus plan talks about using tax credits and for helping low and middle income families to purchase insurance in the private market. And if you're talking about tax credits, in my community, the average income for someone who is uninsured is $12,000. A premium is $13,000 for
a family. They're not paying taxes anyway.
Yeah, they're not going to be paying taxes. What is a tax credit going to do for a person who's making on average $12,000 a year? So I'm just saying the finance committee bill is not going to solve the affordability issue, and it's not going to expand care.
That's Dr. Herbert Smitherman, Jr., Assistant Dean of Community and Urban Health at the Wayne State University School of Medicine in Detroit. Quickly, Deepak Bhargava from the Senator for Community Change. Are you also pushing for a public option through this campaign?
Yes, we think a public option is a key part of what has to come out of this bill, and I completely agree with what the doctor said about the Senate Finance Committee bill, which is inadequate on that score. It also would deny care to many, many legal immigrants, people lawfully residing in the United States, which will have a disparate impact. It doesn't do enough to invest in community health clinics, to invest in culturally appropriate care. So, you know, it's a step, but it's got to be radically overhauled and improved to make it acceptable.
Deepak Bhargava is the executive director of the Center for Community Change, and Dr. Herbert C. Smitherman, Jr., assistant dean of community and urban health from the Wayne State University School of Medicine. You can see videos of the ads from the Health Equity for All on our website, thetakeaway.org. Coming up, we're going to be talking about videos of dog fighting. Is that protected under the First Amendment? The Supreme Court is going to decide, and we're going to talk about it in just a minute. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And we got on the line. We woke up this morning, Mark Bittman, the food legend, food writer from our partner, The New York Times, to talk about the demise of another food legend. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, John. How you doing?
Let's talk about what happened at Condé Nast. We've already discussed the business story of what's going on at the magazine publisher, but closing Gourmet magazine, this is really the end of an era for food writers and for cooks and for, you know, food consumers. What's the significance of Gourmet magazine, which Condé Nast announced it's going to close?
Well, you know, I do think that it was a business decision. It was not an editorial decision, but it is a tragedy from an editorial point of view, because it was a place where probably the most serious food journalism in the country was being done on a regular basis. And as you and I and everyone well knows, journalism costs money. And real journalism costs a lot of money. And it's becoming more and more difficult for people to figure out how to get it done and to keep it profitable. And here's a perfect example of a food magazine that's not shallow, that's not particularly trendy, that's really trying under terrific editorial leadership to do great work, not figuring out a way how to make it profitable.
So the magazine was under the editorial leadership of Ruth Reichel, and she also was the editor of the Gourmet Cookbook, which actually competes with How to Cook Everything, your book, Mark Bittman. Has anyone heard anything from Ruth Reichel as to, you know, her reaction, her sense of what's next?
Well, I haven't spoken to Ruth, and I of course send condolences, but I haven't spoken to her, and I'm sure she was flooded with calls and requests for interviews yesterday. I don't know whether she granted any or not, but I guess your guess is as good as mine to that question.
What about the criticism that maybe Gourmet, as deep and no-nonsense as it was journalistically, it was also a glossy magazine known for, you know, huge picture spreads and maybe not necessarily the most cost-effective recipes all the time?
Well, that's a terrific question, and I wonder about that also. I think that they've tried to make it, certainly under Ruth's leadership, tried to make it much more practical in recent years, but they were walking a tightrope, because at the same time as they were trying to make it practical, at the same time as they tried to tackle tough issues like tomato workers in Immokalee, Florida, and stuff like that, they were also reliant on the top luxury advertising
right.
in this country. You know, so they were doing Rolex watches, and they're doing, you know, expensive cars and expensive travel and so on. So you can't have too populist an audience or too progressive an audience while you're looking for advertisers who are trying to appeal to, shall we say, the upper crust
right.
of society. So, you know, I think that was a bit difficult. But then you know, of course, we know the recession has cut back advertising dollars. You know, this is not just an internet question. This is a recession question.
What do you think? We've got just 15 seconds. Do you think the internet is the big story here, or is it the recession?
Well, I think the internet is certainly part of the problem, but I think the recession is the immediate catalyst here.
Well, people used to have gourmet magazines as their recipe archive. Now you can have it in your laptop computer. Mark Bittman, food writer and columnist for our partner, The New York Times, talking about the demise by Condé Nast of gourmet magazine. Thank you, Mark.
Thanks, John. Take care.
I'm John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Coming up, are dog fighting videos more offensive than pornography, and should they be actually banned, despite what the First Amendment says about protecting free speech? Right now, here's a check on leading stories at 48 minutes after the hour. The first doses of the H1N1 or swine flu vaccine are out this week. Our partner, the New York Times, reports doctors are being swamped now with calls from patients who want it. Supplies are limited, so health workers are first in line. Overseas, Switzerland is denying director Roman Polanski's request to be released from prison. Authorities consider him a flight risk. He faces possible extradition to the United States. Polanski fled the U.S. decades ago after pleading guilty to having sex with a 13-year-old girl.
Rescue workers in western Indonesia are now trying to reach some of the most remote communities. Some rural areas haven't gotten any post-earthquake aid yet. Looking ahead to this afternoon, President Obama is bringing lawmakers from both parties to the White House. They'll be talking about strategy in Afghanistan and Pakistan. This as the president considers a request for more U.S. troops in Afghanistan. Those are some of the stories we're watching this morning.
So free speech and dog fighting. Think about it. If you go online, Celeste, and type in dog fighting videos as a search command, you get literally thousands and thousands of entries just like this one. Listen. What you're listening to here is actually graphic footage. Be glad you can't actually see what's going on here. This video alone received more than 5 million views. Brutal, graphic depiction of an actual dog fight between two pit bulls. For many in America, the whole issue of dog fighting was raised by the conviction of football star Michael Vick for running a dog fighting ring. Vick was banned from the game. He's back now, but his conduct was condemned in the halls of Congress.
Barbaric! Let that word resound from hill to hill and from mountain to mountain, from valley to valley, across this broad land. Barbaric! Barbaric.
But there is nothing new about dogfighting. Yet in its brand new term, the Supreme Court is going to consider whether dogfighting videos, like the one you just heard, constitute speech so abhorrent, so barbaric, that those videos can be banned, like, say, child pornography. Or whether, no matter how ugly, does the First Amendment actually protect videos like this? In a sense, is it the same issue as in The People versus Larry Flint?
I like that I live in a country where I can pick up Hustler magazine and read it if I want to, or throw it in the garbage can if that's where I think it belongs. Or better yet, I can exercise my opinion and not buy it. I like that I have that right. I care about it. And you should care about it, too. You really should. Because we live in a free country.
That's actor Ed Norton playing Alan Isaacman in the movie People versus Larry Flint. Joining us now is Alan Isaacman, a First Amendment attorney who represented Larry Flint in that landmark pornography case. Alan Isaacman, good morning.
Good morning to you, John.
Do you think brutal, graphic dogfighting videos, and there's thousands and thousands of them online and for sale, are protected by the First Amendment?
Yes, I do. I do.
All right. Mary Lou Randor, who's the director of human-animal relations at the Humane Society of the United States, also joins us from Washington, D.C. Mary Lou, do you believe the First Amendment protects brutal dogfighting videos like the ones I just referred to?
Hi, John. As you know, I'm a psychologist, and what I do know as a psychologist is that witnessing violence like this has a very harmful effect on children, families, and communities.
So you would say the First Amendment does not protect it?
I would say that the psychological information has to be considered, and I'm not a legal expert.
But you want them banned. You would want, if it was up to you, you'd ban them, right?
If I were on the Supreme Court, yes, I would.
Adam Liptak joins us now. He covers the Supreme Court for our partner, The New York Times. Adam, explain what the court is going to consider here, and then we're going to try to recreate the arguments that may actually appear before the Supreme Court right here in the studio with our two guests, Alan Isaacman and Mary Lou Randor. Good morning, Adam.
Good morning, John. The thing to remember is that this is a case about speech, not conduct. Every state bans dogfighting. Every state bans animal cruelty. The question is whether commercial trafficking in depictions of animal cruelty should also be a crime. So the guy at the center of the case the court is going to hear today, Robert Stevens,
got 37 months in federal prison for selling a dogfight video, which is 14 months longer than Michael Vick got for organizing dogfights. Mm. And the question is whether a law that Congress passed in 1999 dealing only with depictions of animal cruelty runs afoul of the First Amendment, and whether for the first time since 1982 the court is going to find an area of speech that's so vile that it's going to put it outside the protections of the First Amendment.
All right, Alan Isaacman, First Amendment attorney. You represented Larry Flint. Is this a harder argument to argue for the depiction of conduct that's actually illegal in almost every state? Is it a harder argument than arguing for Larry Flint?
Well, almost anything is easier than arguing for Larry Flint sometimes. But I think the answer to your question is this particular argument should be considerably easier, in my mind, than the argument that we had. Because what we were talking about was injury to human beings. I mean, there wasn't any question that a considerable emotional distress was suffered by Reverend Falwell, who testified to that, and what we were talking about was something where there was a parody that actually made fun of a public figure.
Yours was a libel case. This is something quite different.
This is right. This is harm to animals. Now, in my mind, cruelty to animals is a terrible thing, but we don't treat animals the same way. I mean, most people eat animals. We do a whole lot of things. We test cosmetics on animals. We do a ton of things to animals that. Many of which, if I were writing the laws, we wouldn't do, but we don't treat them like we treat people. It's as simple as that, and so therefore it was an easier argument, I think, saying that my case harmed people, this case harms animals.
Adam Liptak, you cover the Supreme Court for the New York Times, and I'm wondering, this is maybe a sticky legal issue, but, back in the arguments over child pornography, some of the arguments that were made, one of them was, we're talking about children who are coerced into doing this. In other words, these are minors, they're being forced into doing this, they're innocent victims. And it seems to me there's a parallel there, because dogs don't fight like this in real life, out in the natural world, one would say. And one of the arguments I've read is that this is another case in which they're selling videos that are made by harming, by coercing innocent victims. Is that going to play, do you think, in the Supreme Court arguments?
That may have an impact, but as Alan said a second ago, our society's commitment to the protection of animals is nothing like its commitment to the protection of children. So we have factory farming and pharmaceutical testing and so on, and it's not clear that value on the other side of protecting animals, whether correctly or not, is going to be thought to be of the highest order necessary to overcome a First Amendment claim.
All right, Mary Lou Randour, Director of Human-Animal Relations at the Humane Society, how can you make an argument for special protection for this kind of depiction in a society where we slaughter animals every single day?
Well, I don't have to make that argument, because the point is about the commercial depiction of animal fighting is that it doesn't just harm animals. Certainly they're harmed. We see them being harmed. But there's a mountain of psychological evidence that witnessing such violence on the part of children and adults does psychological harm to them. So the harm isn't just to the animal. The harm is also to children, families, and our society.
So if you were in front of the Supreme Court, you would say it's the inflaming of the behavior of the people who watch this stuff that is the harm to society, and that's why we should protect this speech or ban this kind of speech. Alan Isaacman, is there any precedent for the court ruling on that argument?
For the most part, that argument has in our society has been rejected. I mean, the idea being that, look, it doesn't matter whether your speech is offensive, inflames people, it's unpopular. That's the speech that the First Amendment needs most to protect. Mm. I mean, you don't need to protect popular speech that everybody agrees with.
All right, we're down to the last. Go ahead, Mary Lou, very quickly.
I just want to say it isn't that it inflames people or upsets them, that it causes psychological damage and harm that is long-lasting and that is passed on to other generations.
Well, we're getting a sense of the arguments before the Supreme Court. Adam Liptap, any sense on where the court might go with this? We're under a minute now.
This court is actually very protective of the First Amendment. Both the conservatives and liberal justices seem to think of the First Amendment as a value that they're really very concerned about. So I think it may be a little bit of an uphill fight for the people seeking to ban these videos.
Interesting argument. Adam Liptak covers the Supreme Court for our partner, the New York Times. Mary Lou Randor is a director of human-animal relations at the Humane Society in the U.S. And Alan Isaacman, First Amendment attorney who represented Larry Flynt in the People versus Larry Flynt. Thanks to all three of you.
So if you want to weigh in on that debate or anything else, reach out to us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We're also hearing your stories about Afghanistan.
Well, I'm a staff sergeant, served in Iraq. I have 20-plus years in. I'm with the Army National Guard here in Michigan. I'll be going to Afghanistan more than likely, and I feel that we have a mission, and we need to accomplish it. And if it means going over there and being with my brothers and sisters, I'll do so.
How is it affecting you and your family? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway. Thanks for listening to the Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.